From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we'll be discussing the physician's proposal for a national health program. Last week's issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, the most widely circulated medical journal in the U.S., published an article signed by over 9,000 physicians, which laid out a proposal for major reform of the U.S. healthcare system. These physicians propose a system funded from tax revenues, which would include every citizen in the country. Joining us today are three members of the working group that developed the proposal, Gary Dennis, Ron Anderson, and Quentin Young. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Studies funded through the National Institutes of Health on AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and other infectious diseases will be terminated early because of a White House mandate stating that the National Institute of Health must shift funding from existing research in order to finance efforts to develop a new anthrax vaccine. More than 500 researchers will be affected by the order, which was first announced in June by Joshua Bolton, director of the Bush administration's Office of Management and Budget. Funding to develop a new anthrax vaccine was not included in the $1.75 billion appropriation for bioterrorism research. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said that the Bush administration officials gave the NIH this unprecedented order to develop a new vaccine without additional funding. While an anthrax vaccine already exists, Congress and the Bush administration have called for new vaccines based on more advanced technology. Investigators researching HIV, TB, and malaria expressed dismay at the diversion of research funds to anthrax. The three diseases, HIV, TB, and malaria, are responsible for over 6 million deaths worldwide each year, while anthrax caused 6 deaths in the U.S. last year and is not common enough to be tracked in the World Health Organization's database of 35 major infectious diseases. On July 25th, the U.S. House of Representatives approved by a 243-186 vote to pass a bill that would allow U.S. residents to purchase prescription drugs from Canada and some other developed nations. The bill would allow U.S. pharmacists to import prescription drugs manufactured in a number of industrialized countries, provided that the medications are manufactured by companies that use counterfeit-resistant technologies and that the companies have registered their production operations with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. 80% of House Democrats voted for the bill, and 40% of the Republicans in the House also supported the bill, despite the fact that President Bush had openly requested that Republicans oppose drug reimportation. While the majority that supported drug reimportation was substantial, it is less than the 2/3 majority need to override President Bush's probable veto of the legislation. The bill was vigorously opposed by the drug industry trade group Pharma, and the FDA also took a public position in opposition to the legislation, claiming that it could endanger the safety of medications in the U.S. Jack Pitney, in a commentary written in USA Today, attempted to explain the surprising degree of support for the bill among House Republicans. He noted that while the drug industry has supported Republicans for a long time, few things are more frightening to a politician than a room full of angry senior citizens. Pfizer, among the largest drug companies in the world, announced a series of actions designed to prevent Canadian pharmacies from selling drugs to Americans. Pfizer indicated that it would begin requiring 50 Canadian pharmacies to purchase its drugs directly from the company rather than using wholesalers because it was concerned that these pharmacies were selling to Americans. The company will cut off sales to those pharmacies entirely if sales data indicate to Pfizer that those pharmacies are ordering more drugs than they need to meet Canadian demand. Last year, drug prices in the U.S. were 67% higher than in Canada, a report by a Canadian health agency found. As a result, cross-border prescription drug sales have soared to approximately $650 million each year. Pfizer now becomes the fourth major drug company to take action against Canadian pharmacies it believes are selling drugs to Americans. On July 23rd, the U.S. Senate unanimously approved a bill that would require pharmaceutical companies to test the safety of their products in children. During the 1990s, the Food and Drug Administration first announced that it would impose the rule, but U.S. District Judge Henry Kennedy struck down that rule last year, indicating that the regulation exceeded the FDA's authority. The bill reinstated the FDA's authority to require that drug makers conduct clinical trials on the safety and efficacy of drugs in children before the drugs are approved. The requirement would cover only those medications that would be widely used by children, but that are currently only tested in adults. Approximately 75% of medications used by U.S. children have only been tested in adults. Pediatricians are then forced to assume such drugs are safe, and they must guess the proper doses when prescribing for children. The bill, which is strongly supported by the American Academy of Pediatrics, is expected to come up for a vote in the House of Representatives in September. Coming up next, a discussion with three physicians from the working group of doctors who developed a proposal for a national health program in the U.S., which was featured in the most recent issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. All but one of the 26 developed nations in the world provide government-sponsored healthcare systems. In every case, these systems are universal. They include every single citizen of the country, whether rich or poor, young or old, whether they work for a large business, a small business, or are disabled and don't work at all. In all of these countries, every citizen has free choice of which doctors will treat them. And compared to the U.S., all the other developed nations spend about half as much of their national wealth on medical services, despite providing care to all their citizens. And then there's the United States. Here in the U.S., we spend far more than any other developed country. We frequently restrict choice of physician. And despite this, 42 million of our citizens have no form of health insurance at all, and countless others face major financial barriers to receiving the care they need. In January of this year, on this show, I predicted that this year, 2003, would see the largest increase in the number of uninsured in our history. I still believe that prediction will prove to be true, but an even more significant trend is that even those with health insurance are faced with paying an ever-increasing share of their insurance premiums and steadily rising deductibles and co-payments. Despite this, all the major presidential candidates from both political parties preserve the basic structure of the system we have in the U.S., and the national dialogue has not seriously looked at how the much more efficient healthcare systems of the other developed countries are organized and what features of those systems we in the U.S. could learn from. To promote the cause of universal health care, a prestigious group of physicians developed a proposal for a universal health care system that patterns itself on the systems in Canada, Australia, and other developed countries. By the time of its publication last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the most widely circulated medical journal in the U.S., nearly 10,000 physicians had signed the proposal. These physicians propose a tax-financed system in which health insurance funds in each state would pay for all needed medical care. Because all citizens and virtually all medical care would be paid for by these state insurance funds, the private health insurance companies would become obsolete if the proposal were enacted. The physicians estimate that despite generously funding health services without deductibles or co-payments for every U.S. citizen, the system would not cost more than we're currently spending on health care. Savings in the proposal come from eliminating the massive administrative costs imposed by the private health insurance system, by efficient regional planning of health services, and by discounts obtained from bulk purchasing of prescription drugs and other medical supplies. The proposal is available on the web at physiciansproposal.org. Joining us today to discuss the proposal are three members of the working group of physicians who developed the proposal: Gary Dennis, Quentin Young, and Ron Anderson. Gary Dennis is the chief of the Division of Neurosurgery at Howard University College of Medicine in Washington, D.C., and is a past president of the National Medical Association. Quentin Young is a clinical professor of preventive medicine at the University of Illinois Medical Center, a past president of the American Public Health Association, and for 10 years has served as the national coordinator of the Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization that has been in the forefront of the struggle for universal health care. Ron Anderson is president and chief executive officer of Parkland Health and Hospital System in Dallas, Texas, one of the largest public hospital systems in the country. Ron Anderson, Quentin Young, and Gary Dennis, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The physician's proposal for a national health insurance plan, certainly something we haven't seen previously, in at least in many years, in major medical journals. I was wondering if you could give some background as to why you think this proposal is important at this particular time.
Certainly, the healthcare system in the United States is really one of the best in the world when it comes to quality of healthcare that can be provided, the use of new and innovative ways to treat patients with very serious problems. The research is certainly the finest in the world, and unfortunately, though, it's a system where only some of our citizens have access to all those benefits. We have an increasing number of uninsured and underinsured patients and Americans who really have very little way to get access to the best medicines and the best medical treatment, and it seems to get worse rather than better. By the year. Hospitals, especially in the poorer communities, are closing because of the burden of uncompensated care. There are patients that need emergency treatment and advanced treatment where there's no way to pay, or the payment just does not in any way equal the cost of the services provided. A country where we have a significant disparity in the kinds of services, how they're accessed, and where they're located. They're congregated in certain areas where there are an overabundance of services, yet just miles away there may be literally no services available. And it's not necessarily based on income, but frequently it's based on whether patients have a way to pay for the health care in those areas. If they have a way to pay, usually the services are attracted there. But if they don't have a way to pay for them, usually the services aren't. And many of the services, the health care services that are provided, the outcome is directly related to whether those services are accessible to the patients, whether they can receive them quickly and whether they can have primary care. Right now, our system is more directed and based upon a disease model, and which means that patients have to get sick in order to get health care, instead of a health model, which focuses on doing the right things, preventing diseases from occurring altogether, if possible, and certainly catching them early before they're complicated so that you don't end up in the hospital. So we have a system that thrives on disease in order to pay for itself, and we spend a huge amount of dollars in order to do that. We encourage competition amongst companies to go after the few dollars that are there and spend a lot of money marketing services and competing with other companies rather than providing the services that are so desperately needed. It's a system that I think today most doctors are so frustrated with that they would just like to throw up their hands in disgust, because it requires so much administrative paperwork for them in order to get authorization for services, even when patients have health insurance. And when they have it, frequently they have to end up paying out of pocket in order to get the services that they need, because the insurance doesn't even pay for everything, especially when it comes to medications, especially when it comes to your choice of hospital and doctor. I mean, the system we have today frequently restricts the access that patients have to a doctor they might like, or a doctor who is better for them, a doctor that may be more culturally appropriate, one that may understand their language, one that they trust, one that they prefer, but still one that is best and well qualified. I think that's the kind of system that we have, and of course there are many socially responsible physicians, organizations, and institutions that have been grappling with a way to deal with this for years. But I think this is the proposal that Physicians Working Group has for the single-payer national health insurance is probably one of the most comprehensive that has ever been developed by a group of healthcare experts in this country. And it's based upon universal health care, which is what we really need, as well as the backbone of a system that we have been perfecting for years called Medicare. I think that this proposal is unique, and it brings together, I think, many of the elements that are necessary in order to finally get universal health care.
And I think that Gary is on target. I would almost challenge, though, the use of the word system. What we really have is a patchwork a non-system, and it seems to me that the time is coming that physicians are frustrated, patients are frustrated. Many people feel like they're where they thought they would be if the, quote, government ran the healthcare system back in 1993 and 94. Seeing what happened with the corporatization of healthcare in this country since that time, you have to ask yourself, you know, do you have more choice? Do you have security that you'll have healthcare in the future? A recent Kaiser poll suggested that this was the biggest issue on the minds of families in America, 37% listed as the number one issue, even before job security. So, you know, perhaps people realize that this isn't sustainable and that we're spending more to keep this non-system buoyed up, mainly for profit motive, mainly for special interest and others, when it should be the patients and the communities we serve. And I think we have to be fair to providers, but you know, we have to find a better way and a more ethical and a more socially just system. And the truth is, we have more health care, we can produce more health care than anybody can afford. Our problem isn't quality. We can create quality, but we ration by inconvenience. We ration by ability to pay. And we're making some very, very poor decisions that long-term will create a less healthy environment. You have to look at this and say, we should change.
So maybe it's time now to go ahead and describe the physician's proposal. They, as I read through it, they pointed out that there were four underlying principles. And I was wondering, maybe you could start out with those.
First and foremost, it's universal. It takes in every person residing in the U.S. We don't exclude people because of their income level, high or low, or their geographic or racial composition or age. Everybody in, nobody out, okay? The second thing is that the proposal has a very comprehensive package. That is to say, many of the things that are not regularly covered or increasingly not covered at all are indeed in this package. To be explicit, it gives parity to mental health, it provides for long-term care, and it does indeed cover drugs, pharmaceuticals, as prescribed. Another feature of the bill is the fact that it is based on a tax base, and that it is government administrated. Now, that's something that has to be brought to the American public because they have been, in no small way, brainwashed against government programs. And this, despite the fact that government in medicine in the United States in the last half century, for example, has been by and large favorable. The Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control as a public health protection to the whole nation, the public hospitals as places to take care of people nobody else will take care of and train many of America's health professionals. But yet the man on the street, I fear, and I, in fact I know, has been brainwashed to have a lot of apprehension about, quote, government medicine. I guess the important point here is to emphasize this is a government running of the finance, just like Medicare or Social Security, where I think government efficiency has been proven.
And the government running of the finance. Insurance phenomenon, but not of the doctor's office
exactly.
Or the hospital.
Exactly, you anticipate me. Because the system is explicitly kept in private hands, the whole delivery system. Indeed, this bill, to go further among its principles, recovers the traditional, up until 10 or 15 years ago, hospital arrangement. America's hospitals were not-for-profit, community-based institutions. It's only when the marketplace solutions were introduced that these corporations bought up, usually at a much depressed price, these precious local institutions and created these vast hospital chains. I think we need to capture our health system and bring it back to its original orientation and commitment to enhance the health status of the American people, not to make rich people richer.
So in the system that you're envisioning, there would no longer be a role for the private health insurance industry at all. Is that
exactly.
Correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Let me underline that. We pay a fierce price for that. First of all, there's...
You mean having the private health insurance
exactly.
industry?
Exactly. There are 1,600 insurance companies in this country, large and small. Some are huge, some are very small, but 1,600 overall. Well, you don't have to be an economic genius to see that's a formula for disaster. It turns out that the administrative costs associated with that large number of insurance companies means the cost to the consumer is 15% to 30% off the top for administrative costs. And let me assure you, those administrative costs do not typically improve the product or the delivery of the product. That money is so huge, and 15% or 30% of the amounts of money we're talking is mountainous, is so huge because they are invested and have staff and arrangements aimed what? At, by and large, denying care. The money that the insurance companies make is based on how they can find ways of denying patients care. They get a pot of money from an industry, and whatever they don't spend, they keep. So all of their motivation is toward denial of care. Sometimes it's prudent management, sometimes it's cruel denial, and occasionally it's virtually death-dealing denial. And that is what the costs of having a 1,600 different insurance companies. What's the comparison? Well, our own single-payer system, Medicare, which is flawed, but nevertheless has the elements that we're talking about in the government-run system. Medicare comes in at less than 3% administrative costs, and they take care of 33 million elderly who tend to be sicker than their younger counterparts. Under 3%. Is that the lowest it can go? Well, we have Canada, our neighbor to the north, which has a provincial system. And on average, their administrative costs for their system, which covers everybody in Canada, has a comprehensive package. It has literally millions of transactions a year, is 0.9%. Now, when we're talking about, Dr. Malik, every percentage point is like $16 billion. You have a lot of money that you can recapture for health care as opposed to just squandering it to no good end.
To delve into that further, this proposal, as I read it, and I would like you to comment on this, the proposal, as I read it, is extraordinarily generous compared to, not compared to what Canadians and people in other countries are accustomed to, but it's very generous compared to what we in the United States are accustomed to. One of the features of this proposal, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but is to eliminate deductibles and co-payments. Given the current context, that's quite interesting, since the latest trend in efforts to expand health insurance, more Band-Aid-type reforms, is to enact health insurance policies that have absolutely huge deductibles, where the person has no coverage till they've spent $500 or $1,000 or sometimes even $2,000 of their own money. In fact, I have a few patients who don't get any in coverage until they spend $5,000. Can you talk about this proposal?
That's right. They don't go for copays or deductibles. Those are economists' ideas of how to control costs, and the evidence is clear. You put copays, deductibles, in other words, economic barriers to care, and it works in accordance to your ability to pay. Thus, poor people who are typically sicker than non-poor people are more likely to stay away with a $10 copay than a rich person who wouldn't be deterred by a $50 copay. So those economic barriers are foolhardy, and as you say, this bill does away with them on the sound logic that this will keep people in the system and, at the end of the day, reduce their utilization by treating them earlier, before they're ill or early in their illness.
Marvin, I think this is one of those things where we're dealing with ideology and very little evidence. If you look at countries that have provided care to the people within their borders, comprehensively and in a kind of a socially just manner, you'll find that there's very little evidence that copays or anything else actually make people better consumers. It's always thought that if you pay for it, you'll appreciate it. I hear this all the time, and over the years, I mean, that we've implemented some copay and that sort of thing, and try to keep it so it doesn't impede preventive services. So, you know, even in our place, the copay is not for everything, and we try to keep it out of the way of things we know it's to our advantage as a system to provide prenatal care, for example. But there's no evidence in most of the countries that have gone way beyond where we're at that this actually makes people better consumers at all. It's just one of those strongly held beliefs. And when you have, $5,000 copays get in the way of preventive services, there's no question, and children getting care in a timely manner. We're aware of this in public hospitals, and it means sometimes people decide to get one prescription filled but not another if there's a copay with prescriptions, and maybe just the wrong prescription for them not to get. But if they fill their arthritis medicines because they have pain, but pain, they don't feel their antihypertensive medication that they probably need more, but it doesn't hurt them, we see problems develop from that. And so I think that the copays are overvalued by policymakers completely. And I don't think that you can justify them if you just look at the hard evidence.
And it fully covers dental care.
Exactly.
And it covers prescription drugs. And again, people in this country who do have prescription drug coverage are gradually becoming accustomed to more and more copays and cost sharing.
That's correct.
How does this proposal intend to deal with prescription drugs?
Well, it deals with the whole system by observing the obvious fact, the unquestioned fact, that we have twice as much money available as you and I speak for every person in the country, two times as much as the next three most generous countries, France, Switzerland, and Germany spend approximately $3,000 per person, U.S., per year. We are spending $6,000. And I needn't remind you that that per capita expenditure isn't obviously spread evenly among our people. That means that despite the fact that we have, is it 44 million uninsured, and the fact that we have people with very poor insurance, that vast expenditure is there. The bill reasons that if we capture that kind of expenditure and utilize wisely the vast and highly skilled, highly proficient health workforce, I'm speaking, of course, of doctors, nurses, technicians, scientists, all kinds of skilled people, which we have. We don't have to make major training of new deficient sectors in health skills. And finally, plant. We probably have more than enough hospitals in this country due to good reasons, like we learned, didn't we, in the 70s and 80s, that many things we kept people in the hospital for are best treated outside. I always cite the fact when I was in training at Cook County Hospital, if the diagnosis of a heart attack was made, the patient was put to bed for 30 days on his back before he's allowed even up. Now we try and get him out of the hospital in 4 to 7 days, and so forth. The point is that we have the plant and equipment, we have the workforce, and we have the money right now. So that seemingly very generous package, which is so much more than people get today, with all those inhibiting copays and deductibles removed, is a rational utilization of what the country's already committed to.
Finally, the proposal includes long-term care, which we currently pretty much don't have unless you're absolutely destitute. And the proposal covers hospitals, and again, I'm assuming that's without significant deductibles and copays.
Exactly.
Am I correct? Well, let's take a short break. My guests today are Ron Anderson, Quentin Young, and Gary Dennis, and we've been discussing a proposal for a national health program just published in last week's edition of the Journal of the AMA. After the break, we'll discuss the cost control measures included in the proposal, which are estimated to allow generous insurance coverage for all U.S. citizens, while costing no more than we're currently spending on medical care in the U.S. We'll also discuss the health systems in Washington, D.C. and in the state of Texas, and how this proposal might impact these and other parts of the U.S., which suffer from high burdens of uninsured citizens. So stay tuned. Public Health Radio. My guests today are Ron Anderson, Quentin Young, and Gary Dennis, and we've been discussing a proposal supported by nearly 10,000 physicians across the country to develop a universal health care system funded at the state level by designated state insurance funds supported out of general taxation. These funds would replace the 1,600 companies that sell health insurance in the U.S. The proposal appears in last week's edition of the Journal of the AMA and is available at the website physiciansproposal.org. Now back to the interview. So far, we've laid out what people are going to say. This would be incredibly expensive. There's no conceivable way we can afford it. And I want to address that. So you have addressed one element in the proposal that deals with it, which is getting rid of massive amounts of administrative waste in the insurance system.
Yeah.
But as I'm reading this proposal, there are two more elements that do achieve cost control, and I actually would like you to comment on them. One has to do with the particularly in the prescription drug sector.
That's right.
The possibility that if we have a government system, that the cost, the total cost we're going to pay for drugs may actually go down substantially. Recently, the U.S. House of Representatives, in their Medicare prescription drug and Medicare reform proposal, specifically banned any bulk purchasing by the government to try to lower prescription drug prices. And as I'm reading it, it looked to me like your proposal here does the exact opposite. And I was wondering, do you think I'm reading that correctly?
No. I think it's a beautiful example of why this is a practical, prudent proposal. The drug costs, first of all, have been soaring. For the last two or three years, the total cost of prescription drugs has exceeded the total cost of doctor's services. Now, maybe that's the doctor in me protesting, but it wasn't always that way. Now, part of that is desirable. We have better drugs and so on. Much of it is not desirable and represents a huge ripoff. I think the best way to illustrate it is to take the proposals for prescription drugs for seniors, which is today's headline. They propose to ameliorate the cost of prescription drugs for seniors, which are projected to be, over the next 10 years, $1.8 trillion, $1,800 billion in the next 10 years. And the most generous plan that's been considered will ameliorate that by $400 billion, leaving, obviously, $1,400 billion for the patients to pay. It barely bites into the overall cost and makes it and to make it possible for people who need the drugs to get it. Let's just dissect that and show you what monumental reductions you can make by doing what we know now. First off, everybody knows you can go to Canada or Mexico or Europe and get the same drugs. I don't mean similar drugs or bootleg drugs, the very same drugs by the same companies with the same labels and the same quality for half on average. It's 40 to 60% discount. So we could cut the $1,800 billion anticipated cost in the next 10 years in half. It's now $900 billion. Now, lest we think that that you can only do if you're a foreigner, our VA system, which is dedicated to care of veterans, right, they have done that, and they do enjoy that 50% reduction. So it's not pie in the sky. It's there. All we have to do is, in this case, intelligently use market forces. If you're purchasing billions of dollars in drugs, you can be sure you can negotiate a reduction at least as good as Canada.
But I have to buy $80 million worth of pharmaceuticals a year in a hospital. About 75% of the pharmaceuticals are for poor people who live in the community and not at the hospital. They're ambulatory. And we have a program where we buy drugs at a fairly good discount, not as cheaply as the VA system, but certainly cheaper than many retail places, you know, buy them for, even in large quantities. And it makes a huge difference in extending the benefits to many more people.
And it's the goal of this proposal to even extend that, because then the government would be a huge buyer and could really pressure prices downward.
They could do that. And in fact, if you look at Medicare and what Medicare cost and their administrative overhead, they actually have brought prices down.
Finally, in terms of cost control, it looked to me, in my read of the proposal, that the third major method that would allow cost control, despite a very generous proposal that really does not interfere in the doctor-patient decision-making process,
yeah,
in the doctor-patient relationship, that the third major element had to do with having rational planning of expensive pieces of technology. And that was detailed in the proposal in describing how they intended to finance hospital care. And I was wondering if you could describe that.
At hospitals, we have a model that works very well and stimulates, I think, prudence and good practice by the hospital. It's essentially global budget financing. The global budget is quite easy to explain, I think. It's this year's budget extended by a consumer's price index or some reliable index of inflation, and that becomes the next year's budget. And that's the standard. And if there have to be variants from that standard, like capital improvements, extending the size of the hospital because of demographic reasons or epidemiologic ones. Those decisions are made separately, apart from the automatic global budget that the hospital enjoys.
Well, let me just say, one time I visited a hospital in Vancouver. It was the same size as Parkland. We're 940 beds. I have over 200 people employed in collections and in the billing office and in the business office and social workers that help people find payer sources. There were eight people in that office.
Eight people in the
hospital in Vancouver. I think with global budgets, you also have incentive to do primary care and do the things that you should do outside of the hospital to keep people from being in. If you have a global budget, it doesn't reward you for admitting people who don't need to be there. I'll give you a case in point. Our cardiology group did a chest pain protocol here and avoided 900 admissions last year for people who could be treated in the emergency room for 23-hour observation. In a fee-for-service place for profit, we would be cutting our own throat. Those would be funded patients, Medicare patients or whatever. We'd make money. What we did it for was to free up beds so we could take care of other patients, and we backfilled with many poor people. So in essence, by creating a better system, more efficient system, we're penalized because we took care of more poor patients, you see. In a global budget, I would be incentivized to find a better way to treat those chest pain patients so they didn't require hospitalization if they really didn't need it. So it gives you the right incentives sometimes instead of saying, man, if those people were Medicare, I just wrote off, you know, $10 million, and maybe I shouldn't have done that. So I think he gets the right incentives there for systems that are really trying to take care of large volumes of people who are poor. I think there's one of the other things that we ought to probably mention. Health planning has pretty much gone by the wayside in our state. Certificate of needs aren't there, and people are building niche hospitals or boutique hospitals out in the wealthy parts of the community, orthopedic neurosurgical hospitals, cardiac hospitals, hospitals where the doctors don't take call anymore and they're subspecialty, there's no emergency room. And when you see those kinds of things, and they pull away paying patients from inner-city hospitals oftentimes that are safety net institutions or hospitals that, you know, have a full mix of services, maybe they're doing trauma or other things, they're less able even to staff their emergency rooms to take care of people in this sort of circumstance. It's a pernicious thing that's going on all over the country. And one of the things that happens in the model we're proposing is that doesn't happen any longer. I mean, just because it's a good way to suck out the cream, if you will, from the system.
Sucking out the cream means finding and taking care of patients who have good insurance. That's what you mean.
Or profitable services that you want to provide, but you don't want to have an emergency room, you don't want to handle trauma, you want to do the elective scheduled surgery because of lifestyle considerations or malpractice considerations. Bringing services, in communities, actually their safety net or services to their needs. And I think that we need to plan for the service needs of communities, particularly with, the homeland security issues and that sort of thing. Many hospitals would never see any value in preparing to meet the needs of a community because it's not profitable. And, if we have the capability, sometimes we're trying to balance our fiscal responsibility to run the hospital against what the community's needs are, and we know that. But in trauma, for example, or burn, we have a large burn unit. And even though we have a monopoly, because of underinsurance and uninsurance and serving a region on local tax base, we lose, $5 million in the burn unit yearly. The for-profit motives don't create those kinds of services. And when you have planning and you have these global budgets and that sort of thing, and you really do fund what you really feel like you need for a population, I think you'll come up with a much more rational system instead of a system that rations.
Well, Dr. Dennis, you're currently head of the Division of Neurosurgery at Howard University's College of Medicine. And I guess I want to get a sense if it's your impression that the administrators or other people who run that hospital, if they feel that their hospital and the patients that it's trying to serve, if they would be better off with this type of proposal.
Well, first of all, I can't speak for the institution, but my experience with the institution is this, that is very hard to subsidize health care of the uninsured.
And you take care of many of those?
Yeah, we take care of a lot of uninsured patients. In the District of Columbia, in the past 2 years, there's been a real crisis for hospitals. The major public hospital, the District of Columbia General Hospital, closed. The hospital, which also serves the Southeast community, the Greater Southeast Hospital, is about to close. The Georgetown University Hospital was sold to a for-profit company, and the George Washington University Hospital was also sold to a for-profit company. So therefore, the only university hospital, which is a nonprofit hospital in the District of Columbia, is Howard University. And the numbers of nonprofit hospitals, you know, are shrinking. So as a consequence of that, a lot of uncompensated care and a lot of poor people in general, people who don't historically have a physician come to that hospital. As a consequence of that, there is a very significant budgetary crunch. There are always budget pressures every year, and probably every day, because there's so many emergencies being treated because we have a poor system of primary care. As a consequence of that, every day, practically, the budget is being challenged. The reason why the other university hospitals were sold and why the public hospital was closed is because they had huge deficits. It's very, very hard to keep a hospital that treats patients who are underserved and poor open unless there's revenue to do it. So certainly any system that will provide universal access, universal health care, and pay for those services, as well as provide the kind of infrastructure so that a primary care system will support preventive health services, chronic disease management, as well as case management, so patients that need education and need support at home and need medications to keep them out of the hospital will get it. I think that Howard University would be firmly behind a system that would improve things. Right now, Howard University Hospital, along with other urban hospitals, are struggling to stay open because of the burden of all these other unpaid-for services that they provide.
For those who are just joining us, my guests today are Ron Anderson, Quentin Young, and Gary Dennis, and we've been discussing the physician's proposal for a national health program, just published in last week's issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association.
So far we've been talking about the provider side of it, how will hospitals operate and be funded, what medical services will be funded. But let's back off for a second and just say that you're a patient. How would this service work for the average patient? Let's say they've been healthy, but then they get sick and they need to go to the doctor. How would they use the system that you're proposing?
Well, I would say that the way they use the system is the way they would currently with any health care insurance system. They would have a card that would be issued to them, just like all Americans would have, and this card would work wherever they took it. So they take it to a hospital, they take it to a doctor's office, to a medical clinic, to a pharmacy. The card works for them. They won't have a problem accessing the system.
Now, Dr. Dennis, you're a past president of the National Medical Association. And since this show broadcasts to the general audience, presumably mostly not medical people, I think we can assume that they're not going to be aware of the distinctions and may confuse that with the AMA, the American Medical Association. So I was wondering if you could tell our listeners about what the National Medical Association is and what you believe that the attitude of the doctors that it represents, what their attitude might be toward this proposal.
I'm a past president of the National Medical Association, which represents the views of over 25,000 African-American physicians as well as our patients. This particular group was established years ago, over a century ago, when African Americans were denied access to membership by the American Medical Association. Therefore, it's been around a very long time. And the National Medical Association has been a proponent of national health insurance really from its inception. The National Medical Association was the only national medical group which supported the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, and the National Medical Association has continued to lobby and to promote and to educate about the need for health care for the underinsured and the underinsured Americans, as well as to improve access to health care in remote areas, rural areas, as well as in urban communities. The National Medical Association, I believe, very much supports universal health care, as well as all the tenets which are purported in this current proposal.
Now, I'm not aware of other medical membership organizations that represent other minority groups aside other than African American. So I was wondering if either of you, maybe Gary, you may know this. If is it your impression that Asian American and Latino physicians and the Latino communities, the communities they serve, would be favorable to this?
Oh, I believe all minority communities would be in favor of this. Certainly the National Hispanic Medical Association has spoken out in favor of universal health care. The specifics regarding this proposal, I think, could be addressed by all of these minority organizations, and I believe everyone would support it. But I'd say that the National Medical Association is probably best known because it's the oldest, but there are many more minority organizations and organizations that support communities of not only color, but uninsured and underinsured communities that would support this as well.
One last question before we conclude. I have Dr. Anderson, you're from the state of Texas. You're at Parkland Hospital there in Dallas. And I guess I would like to know, what's the story with Texas? Why is it that Texas in recent years has become one of the leaders in the country in not providing health insurance to its citizens? What's the story with Texas? Why is it having so much trouble covering the insurance needs of its population?
Marvin, Texas is unique, and we have one of the poorest Medicaid programs. I think we're 49th or 50th in the nation, and there seems to be almost a feeling among legislators that that this is somehow affiliated with welfare, and it's not. I mean, Medicaid and the welfare issues were separated out many years ago, but recently they actually cut the Medicaid program, the CHIP program, even took mental health benefits away from the CHIP patients because they have a
CHIP is
budget.
The child's health program, right?
Right, and because they have a budget deficit, and they, for each dollar of state money they took away, they lost $2.81 in federal match. And even a very, very prominent and conservative Republican economist here, Ray Perriman, told them that they would lose $19 in economic velocity or ripple effect of a dollar, you know, through the economy by cutting these programs, and that they couldn't fix their deficit by cutting these programs. They shouldn't. They actually should enhance them. They didn't. So there's been an attitude, really, that that this is for poor people, and poor people, you know, need to go to work or something. I mean, I don't know what the real reason is, but it's been here a long time. One in four Texans is uninsured. It leads the nation. We're number one in something. But if you look at the number of Hispanics in Dallas County, 55% of the Hispanic population is uninsured. Being a border state, even though Dallas is 800 miles away from the border, being a border state with many, many people here to work, is an added burden on local institutions, even though the immigrant population here, both legal and illegal, contribute to the economy in a mighty way. There's an unwillingness to develop an explicit system of helping take care of them, and so it's really is by ethnicity you know, kind of a powerful tearing out that occurs with you know, maybe half of Hispanics, a third of African Americans, and then we look at the white population, it's maybe 14 or 15%, but low-income Texans, people who are below 65 and low income, 43% of them are uninsured. Now, how can you? That's why I say I don't think the current system is sustainable. How can we continue to do that? Of course, our ex-governor is now president, and during the time he was governor, he sued the Clinton administration to deal with the immigration issue. Now that he's there, I'd sure like to see him also help us with this, because it is a huge, huge issue. But it's a tradition here that's almost, it's not understandable. And the local dollars we spend, the $300+ million in local taxes, none of that's matched. So the people of Dallas are very giving. They're very, very concerned, and they do tax themselves. The big problem, though, is that we've got very rich counties around us, Denton County, Collin County, others, and they sold their public hospitals, got out of the business, and they've touted the fact that their tax base is lower, but they don't do anything for the poor, and the poor come back to Dallas County. So you have kind of a reverse donut effect. Where, you know, and this is happening all over the United States, by the way, there's a suburbanization of the poor going out to find housing and jobs, but they have to come back into the inner city to get health care. And that, again, from a demographic point of view, is not sustainable. And so, you know, I think that, you know, building more public hospitals would be helpful in building infrastructure, but the best way to do it is to have universal coverage.
What types of actions would you want to see concerned listeners take? Do you feel it's useful for people to talk to their contact their legislators, or maybe even talk to their doctors? What can people do?
Well, I think that talking to your doctor is certainly a good way to get more information about the problems that exist in the current system, as well as to stimulate interest on the part of physicians in terms of how the system should be changed. But certainly contacting your legislators, your healthcare organizations, your local employers and employer groups, I think also is a good way to get more information about this, as well as to stimulate more interest on the part of the public. Because without that, of course, the change is going to be much more lengthy and much more difficult.
I think we do have to go down to the grassroots level, and folks who are very concerned about this need to talk to one another and realize we are in the same boat, and not let us be torn apart in a zero-sum game. I think it would be great to see churches and social groups and others, you know, put together local dialogues as well as national dialogue.
Well, Gary Dennis, Quentin Young, and Ron Anderson, I'd like to thank you all for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing very much.
Marvin, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Marvin.
The Institute of Medicine has published a 6-part report on the impact of lack of health insurance on families and communities. It's available at the Institute of Medicine's website, iom.edu. Physicians for a National Health Program, a group of 10,000 physicians which has devoted itself to the issue for 15 years, is accessible at pnhp.org. And the proposal we discussed on today's show is on the web at physiciansproposal.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.